everyone. Thanks for checking out this podcast. I hope today's conversation inspires you and builds your faith for the moment you are in right now. Know that God's love for you truly changes everything. Enjoy the message.
Amen. Amen. Well, it's been a pretty, I think it's been a pretty cool morning so far. I think we've seen a lot of great stuff, and we've had a chance to participate and worship God together, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's even more down the line after I'm done speaking. But hey, you got me for a few minutes. So this year, this is our fourth, he mentioned it's been 4 years since we've had Easter Blast. This is our fourth iteration of Imagine 24, a second year that we've been able to actually do it in person, which is awesome. And the theme this year was kind of what Liz and Emily were making fun of me about earlier. What would Jesus... what would Jesus blank? What would Jesus ellipsis? What would Jesus, I don't know. And so I know in my mind, I auto-complete that sentence pretty easily. My phone would probably auto-complete it as well. And I'm curious how you would auto-complete that based upon your cultural memory. So let's just try this. Say the word that pops into your head when I go, what would Jesus do? Oh, yeah, okay. The reason, I don't know if the camera is going to work here, but if it does, if you can get a close-up, I'm wearing a WWJD bracelet right now because I was alive in the 1990s. Not just alive, but able to wear one that was about this big. I can't get it down any further than this right now, but that's not important. So the WWJD craze, the What Would Jesus Do craze, was actually based on a novel, which I think is maybe somewhat pertinent for an arts fest, novel being an art form. I can't remember the author's name, unfortunately, but I do have it written down. It's not that important. The novel is called In His Steps, and this became a bit of a craze based upon that. We were asking ourselves, what would Jesus do? And so when artists took this and ran with it, they took the do and they put it in different kind of contexts, right? So actually, hopefully you had a chance to see a lot of great submissions that are out in the atrium right now. They're going to be going away after this afternoon. So after church, if you haven't had a chance, I encourage you to go take a look at them. But I want to show you just a few examples right now. So when people answered this question, they did it in a number of different ways. So if we said, what would Jesus draw? We could see something like this, maybe. Or then we could say, what would Jesus photograph? Or maybe, what would Jesus dance? What would Jesus sing? You can't hear it, but it's beautiful, I promise. What would Jesus write? Again, these are available to be read out in the atrium afterwards if you'd like. Or maybe even, what would Jesus paint? And this is just a couple of the examples of what we have out there for excellent artworks from kind of inside our community and outside our community as well. So, am I saying, or are these artists saying with definitive kind of theological voice, these are the works of art that Jesus would create if he was going to create a work of art? We are not. There would obviously be kind of no way to answer that particular question. Art is subjective, and Jesus himself would probably do it differently in different days. This question is generative, though, and that's what art is supposed to do. So as you think about it, it's supposed to make you do something. It's supposed to push you forward. We'll leave it alone for right now. We will ask two questions, though, that kind of emerged from this as the Imagine team was thinking through them. And these are the two questions. One, was or is, it's complicated when you're talking about Jesus, was or is Jesus an artist? And then second, does Jesus care about art or aesthetics? So we're going to start with the first one. Was or is Jesus an artist? So for right now, I'm going to ask you to park and not even entertain the idea that Jesus is, of course, like the second person of the Trinity, the eternal Son of God, the Logos, the Word, through whom and by whom all things were created, the one who was responsible for the vast cosmos beyond us, the one who's also responsible for the beautiful oceans and the mountains and the jungles and every living thing, the ones that you like and the ones that you're terrified of. So let's just forget about that power of Jesus. And let's just look at the earthly Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth, the man, Jesus the man. It's fascinating for us to try to think about Jesus' early life because the Gospels give us, frankly, pretty scant detail. But if we take a look at Mark chapter 6, Jesus is in his hometown and he's getting ready to share at a synagogue with people, it turns out, that he grew up with. So he's a young man, probably somewhere in his 30s, and he shows up, and this is what we read in Mark chapter 6. After he's shared with them for just a few minutes, they say, "Where did he get these ideas? And what is this wisdom that's been given to him? What are these miracles that are done through his hands? Isn't this the tectone," we left that word untranslated, "the tectone, the son of Mary?" Now this word here, tectone, is, it's a Greek word, and it's usually translated as carpenter, right? We often think of Jesus as a carpenter, the son of a carpenter. This is the most natural translation that we have for it, but it's not the only way to think through this word. In fact, it's kind of like a, well, you can think of it as somebody who works with their hands would be one way. So, you know, carpenter, stonemason. It turns out probably that in the area that Jesus grew up, there probably wasn't actually a lot of wood. And so they're much more likely to work with things like stone and mud and to create their edifices. But yeah, it's a builder. But it has a broader meaning beyond that. It's actually probably closer to something like a craftsman. And craftsman obviously includes things like carpentry and stonemasonry. There is an art to these things, right? If you've ever tried to work with wood, if you've ever tried to do any kind of masonry, you know for sure that there is an art to it. And if you've ever seen anything that I've tried to make with wood or with stones, you will know that there are different qualities that people are able to do because there is an art to these things. The English word art, of course, is kind of a slippery one. I mean, the one that we're going to be spending most of our time thinking about is what we call today fine arts. So things like what's happening over my right shoulder might look like my left shoulder to you, I'm not sure, with Leanne painting over here, right? This is art, the kinds of things that are hanging out in our atrium right now, poems, sculptures, photographs, films. We think of these as arts. They are. They're kind of fine arts. But art also means skill. When we think of martial arts, there's a certain set of skills. When we think of culinary arts, there's a certain set of skills. But again, the most common sense of the word, fine arts, when we think of that, when we think of the question, was or is Jesus an artist in that sense, what say you? We don't have any drawings that he left us. There's this fascinating little piece of scripture that may or may not be in the book of John where he kneels down on the ground and starts drawing in the sand. It'd be nice to know, was it good? So we don't have any of that left. We don't have any sculptures that he made for us, no photos. He made absolutely no films or music that we know of. But you know what we do have from Jesus? We have lots and lots and lots of words. Jesus left us lots of words. And not just preaching and teaching, although there's a fair amount of preaching and teaching. Not just haphazard conversations that he had with people that he was able to have eyeballs with. We have some of that. But also really intentionally crafted words. We have stories and we have aphorisms. We have what we call his parables. And we have the sayings of Jesus, and I could fill not just the rest of the time that I have, but the rest of the time that is available by just dissecting even a handful of his wonderfully crafted words. But we'll take a look quickly at just two examples. We'll start with Matthew chapter 5. We'll put that up on the screen here. And this is from the Sermon on the Mount. And this is just the first three of the so-called Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to them. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Look at these tight little sentences. Every word, obviously these are English translations, but if you could see them in the Greek, they're even shorter for the most part. So terse, and yet so generative, so much to say, the way that they contrast, the way that they work together. You can almost just picture them as poetry on a page. This is not something that just rolls off the tongue. This takes thought, and it's not just because Jesus was, again, the person who could do this, but he was somebody who knew the value of language. And then his parables are really mostly what he's remembered for as a storyteller, right? We don't know, we have to presume he was also a great orator. We don't have any audio recordings. But his stories, even if I just put Luke chapter 15, we won't even read the whole parable of the prodigal son or the prodigal God or however you want to title it. But just this, you know, there was once a man who had two sons. Coming on the heels of these other parables that started with the one who had 100 sheep and then the woman who had 10 coins, and then he just kind of brings it down and just, there was once a man, you know, like once upon a time, right? He had this ability to just weave a tale, and every single character was just enough detail for you to be drawn in, but enough for you to also be able to place yourself into the story. Jesus was a master storyteller. So, was Jesus an artist? I don't know. But I would say at the very least, it seems as though he would be able to understand artists. He would understand the way they think, the way they feel, and the way that they process things. Regardless of where we land on that first question, this second one is actually where we'll try to spend just a little bit more time, and that is, does Jesus care about art or aesthetics? Now, if you don't know this word, that's fine. Hang tight. We'll get there, I promise. So does Jesus care about art or aesthetics? I think that maybe this is a point where we could actually have some understandable pushback on this particular question. And here's why. I think we might be inclined often to think of the God of the Old Testament as being quite concerned with aesthetics, right? Like with ornamentation, with things that are beautiful and rich architecturally. In fact, I won't ask for a show of hands, but if you're going through the walk through the Bible with us, it was just last week, I think, we got to the end of Exodus, where there was just chapter after chapter after chapter of these incredible details about how the Israelites were to construct the tabernacle. What color thread for this? How much gold for that? You know, what kind of oil is going to go in the lamps over here? Like, incredible detail. And I think that we tend to view that, maybe very understandably, as this kind of like old ritualistic approach to religion. And then by contrast, we think of Jesus and his father, you know, the so-called God of the New Testament, and we see that there is a contrast here. So we think, well, he represents the lowly, humble aspects of divinity, right? Jesus was born into a stable. He seems to identify with and spend more of his time with the poor and with the downtrodden. And it's fair to say that he has a complicated relationship with the temple complex of his day and with the kind of Levitical priesthood and how all that's rolling. And so because of this, I think we can really see that there is a tension here in this question of aesthetics. And this kind of old God, new God thinking is in part what has led our particular trunk of the church family tree, what we kind of broadly know as Protestantism, what has led us in some directions in a move to iconoclasm. That's the $25 word of the day, iconoclasm, which is basically just a simple way of saying we have been a part of a history that has actually done whatever we can to push images and imagery, and by contrast, or I guess by association rather, art out of our churches. Sometimes we want to have the most basic worship spaces. It's very understandable. So a way of kind of visualizing this is that iconoclasm is what has helped us so that we can think of this as a worship space, but we can also think of this as a worship space. They're both worship spaces. You might like one over the other, but they're not in any way similar, and yet they serve the same function. Now, I'm actually not here to kind of decry the iconoclastic impulse, and I'm not here to try to hype up fancy-dancy worship spaces. If you took a look around you this morning, sorry, we don't have a 360-degree shot for those of you who are at home, but if you took a look around here, you would have to be the one who would have to judge for yourself what we feel about aesthetics in our worship space. But as Christians, we would say, you know what? Here's the thing. Jesus went on record in Matthew 18 as saying, where two or three gather in my name, there am I with them. So boom, right? I can worship anywhere I want. I don't need a fancy worship space. And I would say, you're right. Absolutely. But then I've just distracted us from the actual question, so I'm sorry. What we're actually trying to talk about is not where we worship and all that kind of good stuff. We're trying to ask, does Jesus care about art or aesthetics? And I think, believe it or not, we might find that this is actually an important question. Now, as the Imagine team was preparing for this weekend, we started wrestling with this question really a number of months ago, and we came across a scholar by the name of, bear with me, it's long, it's Dr. W. David O. Taylor, and we're just going to call him David for short for the rest of the time. David has done a lot of work on this particular topic, and I remember coming across David's name, it would be a few years ago probably, when I saw a video on YouTube, a video that absolutely blew my mind, and here's why. He brought together two people that I never thought would cross paths. Do you know who the band U2 is? Okay, if you are old enough or young enough to not know who the band U2 is, that's totally fine. But they were important enough to have just opened what is the kind of most fancy-dancy concert space in the world right now, the Sphere in Las Vegas. They were the band that was. So if you don't care about U2, at least care about the Sphere. It's pretty cool. So U2, there's a band, and then I actually have a little video. The lead singer of the band is Bono, and this is Eugene Peterson. This is David. Eugene Peterson is the author of The Message, the translation paraphrase of the Bible. This is a cool conversation about the Psalms. Just check it out. But more importantly, these books are the books that David wrote, all about the theology of worship and the arts. So the guy's done his homework. And this particular book, the one that we've drawn most heavily on this morning, is Glimpses of the New Creation, Worship and the Formative Power of the Arts. And so if you're like, your ears are burning and you're like, I want to know more about this, I want to dive deep, highly recommend that particular resource. I was able to have a conversation with David just last week. And in a few minutes, I'm actually going to share a bit of a clip from that conversation. I went into it with an understanding about some of the stuff, but he said a few things that really changed my understanding and changed my approach towards it. I know that what I said earlier, the word aesthetics, can kind of be a bit of a hiccup. Maybe we don't necessarily know what it is, or maybe we don't like it. Maybe we are the kind of people who shy away from the idea of the fancy, the ornamental. The only time that we even really run into the word aesthetics most of the time is if you think of an esthetician. And when I think of an esthetician, I know if you're an esthetician here, I know you do more than nails. I know you do. But I just think of you as being somebody who largely spends a lot of time with nails. And I don't think that most people go to an esthetician because they want their nails to be strong. I don't think most people go to an esthetician because they want their nails to be healthy. I think they go because they want their nails to be pretty. So I think of aesthetics, I think of the word aesthetics as being something superfluous, like unnecessary, right? Nice, but not required. But again, just as we've kind of had to unpack the word art, we've had to unpack the word tectone, the word aesthetics hangs out here as a bit of a misnomer if we think of it as only the fancy and the unnecessary, because actually at its core, what the aesthetic word speaks to is our senses, our ability to sense. We are human embodied creatures, and all of us have different abilities to sense, but they're all rooted on our five senses, right? So sight, sound, smell, touch, and taste. These five senses are happening for most of us almost all the time. And it's our engagement with these senses, the only way that we can actually relate to the world, that is what the aesthetic word refers to, our embodiedness, our sensoriness. So, arts, not the skills, but the actual pieces of art, the objects of art, they take ideas, things that we can't see, things that we can't smell, taste, or touch. They take the disembodied and they make them real. They make them something that we can sense. They make them aesthetic. Now, remember what I said just a few moments ago, that our current feelings, for not all of us, but for many of us, about this question can come down to this idea of the Old Testament ritualistic God and the New Testament God. But church, we believe that God is one. We believe that he is the same God, and we, the same God who spoke creation into being, the same God who is concerned about whether or not we are engaging with this world in a beautiful and lovely way, he is the same God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Aesthetics do matter. So with that in mind, I'm going to direct your attention to the screen for just about 3 or 4 minutes as David gives us a bit of a word about this that I think and I pray will be helpful for us this morning.
Jesus takes dirt and spit in order to make mud to heal the blind man John 9. He doesn't have to do that. And there are plenty of places where he simply speaks and people are healed. Mm-hmm. But he, in whom all of creation, you know, is made, and he who was born of the flesh of Mary and who remembers that we are made of dust, delights to use, you know, dirt. You know, he uses his own spit to touch the eyes of the blind man in Mark 9 and uses spit again on the tongue of the deaf in Mark 7. All these very sensory things all throughout the Gospel of John, all the signs are aesthetic, you know, experiences. You know, the water to wine and the walking on water and the feeding of the 5,000. All of that is very sensory rich. Mm-hmm. Not because, again, we're not smart enough or spiritual enough to get it just by a word. I mean, he could have thought, you know, if you want, of course, you can think anything to be. He doesn't have to be present physically for things to happen, right? But it delights him to use the physical world because he blessed it in the very beginning. I see that all throughout his ministry, and it leads me to conclude, yes, he cares about aesthetic things. And we're not graduating from aesthetic things. We're not graduating to this sort of disembodied heavenly place. Our true destination is the new creation, where once again, you know, we will be immersed in an aesthetic world that will be freed from the stain and warping force of sin. Mm-hmm. And right now, between those two eras, we get to trust that God delights to use aesthetic things to help us to know and love him and help us to know and love our neighbors and help us to know and love ourselves because we're supposed to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. creation is our home and new creation will be our eventual home and it will be physical and material. And you see all throughout the Old Testament, all throughout the New Testament, how God delights to use physical, material things. So much so that he decides to become it. And not sort of it. You know, the language from John 1 is sarx from the Greek, which is flesh, and soma is the other word that is used elsewhere, which is, you know, body. But he becomes fleshy flesh, like as fleshy flesh as you can get. And it is his delight that we encounter, certainly in his ministry, that people encounter God, very God, true God, light of life, you know, true God from true God in the person of Jesus, in his own flesh. And it's, he feels so much utter delight in it that he rises from the dead in this resurrected flesh. And everybody wants a piece of it. And he says, go for it, you know, touch me and see, I am not a ghost. And then later, obviously in 1 John, you know, that which we have seen, heard, touched, tasted. This we present. This is, that's the life. And so the arts are very physical things. Mm-hmm. And as physical things, as material things, they like participate in the ground of this graced physical world that God has made. And so it's like they're downstream from what is like most primary, which is the physical world, the created world is already graced, already capacitated, already blessed to be something through which we would know and love God. And we see that in the Lord's Supper. Every time you take it, you'll have some sense of, you know, encountering him.
And it's this last little bit that he just mentioned at the very tail end that I think I want to spend just the last few minutes together today with. It's this idea of the Lord's Supper as maybe the ultimate sensory experience. I mean, is it a work of art in the sense that you could take a picture of it? Yes. There are untold pieces of art that have been inspired by the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper. But really, just the instantiation of it itself, it's the fact that you have something to drink and something to eat, and that Jesus left that with us is something that we should do regularly together, I think speaks a lot about, like as David was saying, his desire for us to delight in the physical world, not in the way that it alienates us from him, but in the way that it reveals to us him. Because we can't actually know God without knowing him in ourselves, through our senses, right? Sight, sound, scent, touch, and taste. And I think just the bread alone, I know that this won't be everybody's universal experience this morning, but if you were to be able to break bread with somebody across the table, you can see this beautiful loaf of bread, all of the different crevices, the color of it. I especially love the bottom. It's a beautiful thing to look at, to be honest with you. And not only can you see it, but you can smell it. Especially if it's fresh baked, there's quite nothing like fresh baked bread, right? And I don't know if this is going to work, but I'm going to do my best. It's conceivable if I get really quiet, and if you get really quiet too, that you can even hear as the bread is being broken, right? And of course, it's very easy to touch. It's almost impossible. Nay, it is impossible to be able to engage with it without touching it. And of course, that last thing that we'll do together later is we'll be able to taste. And truly, in every sense, both the cup and the bread give us an opportunity to envision and experience God as he really is. Is he a loaf of bread? Is his blood juice? No. And yes. Can you know God without experiencing him, without sensing him? Kind of just no. We have to be able to do more than know God. We have to know God.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more about Moncton Wesleyan, we invite you to visit our website at mw.church. We are here to help you with any questions you might have. See you next time.